what we learned investigating the death of Chicano student activist Oscar Gomez.
It sounds like you ran almost every theory to its end.
Binge all 8 episodes of Imperfect Paradise, The Forgotten Revolutionary, wherever you get your podcasts.
From 89.3 KPCC and KPCC.org, this is Take Two. I'm Amy Martinez. Thanks for joining us today and glad to be back here at Take Two, the host chair of KPCC. All right, coming up, the state tapped Blue Shield to help with the vaccine rollout, despite California County's resistance to it. One reason is that Governor Gavin Newsom goes way back, actually, with the insurance provider. We'll tell you more. That's coming up just ahead. But first, we're going to catch up on the COVID-related news from the past few days. And we're turning the corner on vaccinations, and there's also a new one on the horizon to help. At least it's new to a lot of us, because the rest of the world, at least parts of it, have been having it. So now schools only have to keep kids 3 feet apart instead of 6, as long as they wear a mask. So there's a lot to get into with COVID-19 and the pandemic, and we're going to bring in one of our experts. That's Paula Cannon. She's a professor of virology at the University of Southern California's Keck School of Medicine. Paula, good to talk to you again.
Hey, hi there.
All right. Now, this morning, news came out about how the AstraZeneca vaccine performed in U.S. clinical trials. And right off the bat, Paula, the information appears promising. You're the expert. Give us the top line details.
Yeah, no, it does look good. So this is like, what they call an interim report. So it's kind of like a progress report. But it's a really big trial. They've got about 32,000 people in it, and it's been mostly done in the USA. And it's good news. Basically, the vaccine looks to be about 80% effective overall in, preventing any type of COVID symptoms. And importantly, it's 100% effective in preventing serious disease or death. And the other thing in this trial that is kind of different than the other trials is that it had a lot of older people also enrolled, and they saw just the same good, strong protection in this group of older people. So I think it's really good news all around.
On those two numbers, Paula, the 79% overall efficacy versus the 100% efficacy against a hospitalization and severe disease. What's the difference? Are we talking the 20% left over that gets the 100% protection against severe disease?
No, it's really complicated, because what you measure in a vaccine trial, efficacy, doesn't completely translate to saying, now I've got a 20% chance of getting infected. Okay. Because your risk of getting infected is a combination of how good your vaccine is, but also, frankly, how likely you are to be exposed to COVID. So I always take these efficacy measures and just say, well, the actual real world situation is likely to be better. And we're starting to see that, as we're vaccinating more people, we're starting to get, real world information. And all of the vaccines so far are holding up very well.
So what's the likelihood then, you think, that this will be the next vaccine to get approved for use in the U.S.?
Yeah, no, I think it's, looking at that data, it's quite likely that, AstraZeneca will go to the FDA quite soon to ask for an emergency use authorization. That's the process. And I think they'll probably get approved. And what's kind of interesting is the question of, will we need it? Because even on a very, fast sort of timeline to get approval, it's not going to be here before probably May. And we've heard from President Biden that he said with just the 3 vaccines we already have, Pfizer, Moderna, and Johnson & Johnson, that he expects there's going to be enough vaccines available in May for everyone who wants it. So we may be in the glorious situation of actually, it's kind of like, like AstraZeneca will be the cheese course after dessert.
Right,
we'll be like, thanks, but actually we're good. We don't need you.
That would be 4, right? And I know the U.S. has been shipping out some AstraZeneca vaccine to different countries around the world while it's waiting to be approved here. I'm wondering, Paula, do you think at all that there is any kind of worry among people like yourself that the bad press or the kind of tough news that AstraZeneca vaccine has had in the last few weeks might get people to think, well, I don't want that one if that's the only one available?
Oh, yes, sure. And we're already seeing these sort of vaccine wars. I mean, honestly, people say to me, which one would you prefer? And I'm like, Lordy, whichever one they've got in the syringe when I turn up. I mean, we're sort of, these trials all got done at sort of different times. So the absolute numbers, while 79% sounds like a very concrete number, it kind of shouldn't be taken that way. I think the good news is that way beyond our wildest expectations, all of these vaccines so far are massively outperforming what we expected, and they're all going to protect you 100% from serious illness and death, and with a high degree of probability will probably just completely protect you from any infection. So gosh, you know, just get whichever one you can. They're all going to be good.
Now, we've talked about coronavirus variants before. City of Pasadena has identified a patient with the UK variant. Can you remind us, Professor, how contagious that might be and how effective that the vaccine is against it?
Yes, the UK variant, close to my heart. So, you know, it's definitely here in the US. I think there's been about 500 cases in California that we know about. And with these variants, we don't always know which ones they are, because you have to do this extra test called sequencing to find out. But I think the data about the UK variant says that it does spread more easily and gets transmitted more quickly, maybe even as much as 50% more transmissible. So, you know, it's a concern that it's here. But again, you know, the good news is that all the things that we know that stop even the, you know, the vanilla variants of the virus are all going to also stop even a more infectious and more transmissible strain like the UK variant.
Before we get to a question from a listener, you said it can be a concern. Is it a concern against the return to normal? That, because it seems like we're rounding that corner, Professor. We're so close to that I think people get concerned over that not maybe happening when we think it might.
Sure. And I think, you know, we're all remaining, you know, keeping an eye on everything. Obviously, what we don't want to see in an ideal world is the virus evolving even in a small way to be more transmissible, or even to have a slight resistance to antibodies. So from people who've previously been infected or people who've been vaccinated. So absolutely, we're all, you know, really keeping watch over that. But I think the good news is that no matter how this virus changes, it can still be prevented by all the things that we know, you know, to do, you know, mask wearing, social distancing, yeah, small groups, being outdoors. And then we also have this massive weapon in our arsenal now of vaccination. And as we get more people vaccinated, these viruses, no matter what variants they throw at us, are really going to, you know, have nowhere to go.
Now, when it comes to case numbers going down, one of our listeners wrote in a question about that in relation to the amount of testing that's happening. And here's a question, quote, "I'm pretty concerned that the COVID stats for infections are starting to degrade because most testing centers are being converted to vaccination centers." Not to refer to a previous national official, but if you are not testing, then how can you really know that your infection rate is going down? Is your infection rate only going down because your volume of testing is going down, Professor?
Oh, that's a good question. I think I can reassure your listener. You know, certainly some of the mega sites like Dodgers Stadium are no longer doing the testing because they're doing the vaccination. But we've also got way more kind of local options, you know, your local CVS and Walgreens, and many workplaces are set up to test people. For example, at my university, USC, we test all students weekly and every employee who needs to come on the campus. And then we've got, like, you know, take-home, mail-in tests that people can do. So there's lots more options. And actually, the numbers are still really good. So in California, in this past week, we've done over 1 million tests. And only 1.6% of them were positive, which is the low number we feel good about. But, you know, 1 million tests is not to be, you know, yeah, is not to be dismissed. It's a pretty high number still.
We're talking to Paula Cannon, virologist at USC's Keck School of Medicine. Now, over the weekend, the state of California adopted new guidelines from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention about social distancing and young kids. CDC now says a 3-foot distance between kids is okay as long as they're wearing masks. Now, I should say, Professor, the agreement between the teachers and the Los Angeles Unified School District has a 6-foot rule baked in, so that won't have an impact on those campuses this spring. But what are the implications of this when it comes to schools that do not have that baked in, or for school in the fall, possibly, to have a 3-foot rule?
Yeah, no, it's a huge move for practicality, isn't it? I was thinking about this, and maybe the best visual is, you know, the difference between a 3-foot and a 6-foot spacing is like the difference between all the kids walking around with a hula hoop around their waist, and a 3-foot spacing means their hula hoop is a 6-foot hoop. But 6-foot spacing means it's a 12-foot hoop. So it just, yeah, you know, right. It just makes these classrooms now practical. I think the math is that you can fit 4 times as many kids in a classroom if you reduce the spacing from 6 to 3. So as long as that's combined with, you know, high mask wearing adherence, good ventilation, and, you know, smaller and stable groups of students with the option to do rapid contact tracing, then I think it's a very safe strategy.
Now, not all families have responded to that survey, but it appears that less than half of the students in LAUSD are going to go back to campus. But for those families who are sending their kids back, Professor, how confident are you that they should be worried about any potential risks?
Yeah, I mean, it's an individual decision. You know, COVID is low risk to children themselves, but an infected child can spread it to the rest of the family. So maybe, you know, think about, are there older relatives living in the house? And if so, please get them vaccinated so that if your kid did get infected, that, you know, really reduces the risk to the rest of the family. But I think in general, you know, we're seeing that schools, when they have these all these, you know, procedures in place, are actually, school is a very low risk activity. So again, I would say, as long as you feel confident in the measures that your school district has in place, and that your kids will understand and follow the guidelines, then I think you can actually feel fairly confident. And clearly, it's an incredibly important thing to get our kids back at school at this stage.
What about this, Professor? Because I was thinking, okay, so let's just say the summer goes on and more people get vaccinated. And that's obviously a good thing. But say I haven't yet, but I know that more people are. Is it okay for me to plan a vacation? Maybe in August or September?
Oh, boy. You know, get vaccinated, okay? That's
well,
what
no, I
say.
Do, so, yes. Yeah. I realize, yes, that's a given. Yes. But I'm saying if I'm still not yet, and I know that mm-hmm. lots of people are, is it starting to get safer for me to think about that?
All right. So what you have to do is think about both the risk to you as a non-vaccinated person and then the risk from you, depending where you're going. So sometimes you just have to really look at the numbers. You know, we are getting lower rates here in California. So, you know, come August, if the rates are still as low and lower, that's good. Think about where you're going. You want to be going somewhere that also has equally low rates. And then, you know, frankly, just be aware of the rules at your destination. You know, do you need to quarantine when you get there? Do you need to get a negative test before you go? And please don't go somewhere where a lot of people aren't following the rules, eh? So, you know, we are so much better than Miami, aren't we? So, you know, don't go there. But I'm also going to pick up on something you just said about vaccination, because although there are no special rules or changes at the moment yet for vaccinated individuals, I think it's likely that there will be. You know, vaccinated people with proof of vaccination will be able to get out of a testing or quarantining requirement. Okay. And some, you know, places may even require you to have a vaccine for you even to be allowed to come. So, you know, if you are thinking about getting vaccinated and you're maybe hesitating, I would just say when it's your turn, don't hesitate. You know, the potential to travel effortlessly and safely should be a pretty good incentive.
Okay, I knew the answer was generally no, Professor. I wanted to be a little devil's advocate on this real quick. Oh, and one thing real quick. I saw that Cedars-Sinai had some research into progesterone therapy for men. What did that find quickly?
Oh, yeah. So that's based on the fact that, you know, men have a worse outcome than women, and postmenopausal women also have a worse outcome than younger women. And so the speculation that it might be down to differences in sex hormones.
Oh.
Progesterone is one of those sex hormones. So there was a little trial at Cedars here in LA that gave, I think it was about 40 men, progesterone shots, and it did improve their outcomes.
Oh,
and it probably works the same way as some of the other steroid drugs we've heard about as being an anti-inflammatory.
That's virologist Paula Cannon with USC's Keck School of Medicine. Professor, thanks a lot.
You're welcome, mate. Take care.
Imagine if you could charge your electric vehicle at the places you already love to eat, shop, and play. Whether you're at the movies, on your weekly grocery trip, or running errands at your local mall, Volta EV charging stations are built around your day-to-day and located in your community and nationwide. All you have to do is check in, plug in, and go about your day. It's EV charging made convenient. Download the Volta app to find your new favorite place to charge.
Summer. I can hear the music play, I hear the drummer. I can hear the children say the snow will fall.
Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC and streaming on the KPCC app. I'm A. Martinez. All right, initially, the process of getting shots into the arms of Californians did not go smoothly. So the state pulled in Blue Shield to be a third-party administrator. That was back in January. Now, the problem is county health officials haven't been exactly eager to team up with the insurance provider. In fact, only one county out of the 58 in the state have entered into an agreement. So how did Blue Shield score a no-bid $15 million contract to oversee California's vaccine distribution? Reporter Samantha Young did some digging on this longstanding relationship that Blue Shield has with Governor Gavin Newsom. She's California politics correspondent for Kaiser Health News and Kaiser Healthline. Samantha, all right, before we get into the backstory of Governor Newsom and Blue Shield, why have counties been so critical of this agreement with Blue Shield?
Yeah, well, thank you for having me on this afternoon. Well, the counties are simply are scratching their heads wondering why a company was brought on to do a job that they feel they've been trained to do and historically do have done for decades. It's their job to do this public health task to vaccinate Californians. They do this with other diseases out there, and they know they have the contacts. They know where people in their community live. They know how to get vaccinations to the most vulnerable. And so they were left wondering, why is this private insurer the one to come in and to lead this effort?
So it was almost as if they felt that this was just kind of put on their laps and they had to figure it out?
Pretty much, yeah.
All right. Now, Kaiser Permanente is also working with the state for the vaccine rollout. What's unique about Blue Shield's position in all this?
True. I'm glad you brought that up, because there's a little bit of confusion about the role of Kaiser Permanente versus Blue Shield. And Blue Shield was given this $15 million contract. Kaiser Permanente, not given any money. They were given sort of a memorandum of understanding. They are they're being treated as a provider, where they still have to, they're advising Blue Shield, and they are. So they're not really doing, they're not coordinating everything like Blue Shield has been asked to do.
So you mentioned the $15 million. What exactly, then, aside from the $15 million, although that's a lot, what is Blue Shield getting in exchange for being this third-party administrator?
You know, $15 million does sound like a lot, but in the world of government contracting, it actually isn't a lot. And so when we ask that question, you know, it's the prestige. It's the getting their name out there. That's where you get the big bang for your buck. It's the marketing. And, you know, now when people think about California COVID vaccine, they're thinking Blue Shield. That goes a long way.
Yeah, I got to admit, I mean, we're talking about it. A lot of people definitely had that on their minds when this news came down that Blue Shield is now a big part of this. All right, so the relationship between Gavin Newsom and Blue Shield, because in digging through campaign finance data, you found that Newsom and Blue Shield go way back. They go way back to his time as mayor of San Francisco. Can you tell us how that first started?
Yeah, we did. I reported the story with my colleague, Angela Hart, and the two of us kind of dug through the campaign data back to when Gavin Newsom was running for city supervisor. Actually, his third term on the Board of Supervisors in San Francisco, he got his first check, $500 in 2002. But I'd say the big investment came when he was mayor, and he had a homeless program that he was really trying to push. It was a little bit, it was a new program, a new concept, really trying to get businesses involved and to hook up social services.
Yeah. Project Homeless Connect, right? That was the project.
Exactly. Yeah. And so they gave him a $25,000 check, and they were there for him and really tried to get this, kind of get some money into the program. And that meant a lot to him. We interviewed a lot of his allies from that time. And over the years, the Blue Shield has given to not just his homeless programs, but also to all of his political campaigns. And they've basically been there for him every step of the way as he has gone higher and higher in the political office.
And $23 million, is that round about the total that it's added up to?
Yes. $23 million. And I say, but most of that has gone to his homeless initiatives.
We're talking to Samantha Young, California politics correspondent for Kaiser Health News and California Health Night. Now, for context, Samantha, as far as lobbyists and interest groups in Sacramento, how powerful is Blue Shield? And when it comes to how business is done in Sacramento, I mean, how typical of a relationship is the one Blue Shield has with Governor Gavin Newsom?
Look, a lot of industries have some very powerful connections in Sacramento, and healthcare is one of the most influential. They rely on these connections to not just get bills passed, but to kill certain bills they don't want regulations on. Blue Shield, they have cultivated a relationship with the governor. There's no question. And one of their lobbyists is one of the most well-known lobbyists in the city. So, you know, I think when we spoke with some of the governor's advisors, they said they felt that one of the reasons that he asked Blue Shield to give them this contract, in their opinion, is because they felt that Blue Shield was a company that had proven themselves to him. It was a company that had been there for him since the beginning, that he knew they could do the job. So that just speaks to the relationship that he's had with them.
And Samantha, just so anyone who's wondering knows, is there anything unethical being looked at when it comes to this? Anything criminal at all? Or is it just kind of the way it looks is what people might have a problem with?
Well, that's a great question. And, you know, we did talk to a number of different sort of campaign ethics experts. And, you know, no, there's no quid pro quo, but it is all about appearances. It's very hard to prove a quid pro quo when it comes to these sort of things. And I don't think that's what anybody is necessarily making that direct connection, but it is all about the appearance for sure.
One of the things that I kept hearing when the news of this came down is that, well, it was a no-bid contract because it's an emergency. It's an emergency situation, and California doesn't have the time for people to bid on this contract. How much does that hold water here?
We've heard that a lot during this pandemic. The governor has these emergency powers to issue regulations. Certainly, this was a no-bid contract that was announced in January, but it then took a couple of, I want to say at least a month to then finalize all of the details of the contract. I don't know. I guess it could be fair, but I don't know. I think you could have a sped up process, but it's certainly an argument that we have heard come out of the Newsom administration a number of times in the past year.
One more thing, Samantha, while we have you here. Any word if Blue Shield is throwing any money into Governor Newsom's fight against the recall?
They have not put any money in since they've been given the contract, but they have given to the governor's ballot measure committee. They gave back in 2019 and in 2020 about a total of $269,000. And that's money that the governor could use out of that ballot measure committee to fight the recall.
That's Samantha Young, California politics correspondent for Kaiser Health News and California Healthline. Samantha, thank you.
Thank you for having me on today.
Support comes from Japan House LA presenting Yes, Kawaii is Art. Express yourself. Kawaii translates to cute or adorable, yet its influence extends beyond aesthetics to encompass fashion, art, technology, and even social behavior. Sebastian Masuda, the king of kawaii, brings together multiple artworks unraveling the kawaii concepts to foster a sense of joy, innocence, and community as a tool for self-expression and representation. Visitors can step into this colorful world to feel the aesthetic for themselves. May 2nd to November 3rd. No admissions fee. More at japanhousela.com.
Just one look at you, and I know it's gonna be a lovely day.
Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC and most places where you get your podcasts. I'm E. Martinez. Over the last week, we've heard some very moving sermons from faith leaders around Southern California, reflecting on the past year and what it has all meant. These sermons have been made possible through a partnership with USC's Center for Religion and Civic Culture. So today we bring you just one more encouraging word. This one's from Reverend Mandy McDowell. She is senior minister at Los Angeles First Unified Methodist Church in downtown Los Angeles. And her sermon is titled, Suffering Does Not Have the Last Word.
A little over a year ago, I was preparing to offer communion to my congregation. Los Angeles First United Methodist Church owns land on the corner of Flower and Olympic, near the Staples Center. We meet outdoors under pop-up tents in the middle of our beloved, drowsy city. And on this gray January day, our parking lot was beginning to fill up with sleek black vehicles transporting attendees to the Grammys. As I approached the first parishioner to offer him the communion elements, he whispered over the low din of traffic, Kobe Bryant is dead. As the days stretched into weeks of mourning, the news cycles continued with reports about the helicopter crash, which took the lives of 9 innocent people.
The LA Times is reporting that retired Los Angeles Lakers basketball star Kobe Bryant has been killed in a helicopter crash. It happened this morning.
Even though it has been several hours, it is still stunning to say the words that Kobe Bryant, the legendary NBA star, is dead tonight.
Interspersed were ongoing updates about the virus, which was slowly starting to appear in the United States. For many Angeleans, we couldn't imagine anything worse than a beloved sports hero in the prime of his life, dying alongside his daughter and so many of their friends. As the flowers began to fade and the murals began to dry, the tears of mourning shifted into the quiet dread that the deadly strain of the coronavirus was not being contained. March 15th, 2020 was the last day my congregation met for worship in person. Since then, we have moved from our tents in the parking lot to our homes for those who are blessed to have them. I went from being a street preacher to being a televangelist. Now, we are in exile, and our makeshift tabernacle is packed away in the pod that sits on our lot. We have traded passing the peace for greetings in the chat box. The Christian tradition has just begun the season of Lent. This is our opportunity to enter into the wilderness, just as Jesus did at the start of his ministry. This season is typically dedicated to spiritual disciplines of fasting, prayer, and austerity. We're invited to give something up, just as Christ sacrificed on our behalf. But this year, it felt wrong. It felt wrong to invite my congregation to give something up, because we've already given up so much. Our health, our security, our work, our normal ways of being. The grip that sorrow has on our hearts is unyielding, and we're living through an ongoing trauma. The prayer of my heart is less often one of praise, and more often an echo of the Israelites' plea with God, "Why have you brought us up out of Egypt to die in the wilderness?" The Christian tradition is steeped in suffering. We believe that God entered the world as Jesus. We believe that God lived, suffered, and died so that none of our human experiences would happen outside of God's own experience. God chose to suffer because we suffer. But we also believe that suffering does not have the last word on our experience. The scripture says, God did not send his Son into the world to condemn the world, but in order that the world might be saved through him. I continue to hope that even if what we've lost can't be restored, that we can be saved from our despair. Rather than being defined by our suffering, we have dedicated our Lenten discipline to hope. This year, we are choosing to be defiant in our joy and subversive in our hope, because we are defined by who we are as God's beloved children, not by what we have lost. Amen.
That was Reverend Mandy McDowell with her sermon, Suffering Does Not Have the Last Word. You can read her text and that of several faith leaders in our community at crcc.usc.edu. That's crcc.usc.edu. You'll see a report pinned to that main page titled Bridges Over Troubled Waters. And we're going to close the show on a bit of a sad note. Lakers Hall of Fame forward Elgin Baylor died of natural causes today in Los Angeles. Baylor was born in Washington, D.C., and the story goes he was named Elgin after his father looked at the watch he was wearing to see what time he came into the world. See, Elgin was a popular brand of watches at the time, and actually on the court, Baylor was as dependable as those watches were on people's wrists. He was an 11-time All-Star, averaging 27 points and 13 rebounds per game for his career. Baylor spent his entire 14 years with the Lakers, first couple of seasons in Minneapolis before moving with the team to LA in 1960. He and Jerry West teamed up to make the Lakers one of the most exciting shows the NBA had to offer. They made 8 appearances in the league finals but fell short each and every time. And the worst part is that they lost to the Boston Celtics in 7 of those series. Baylor retired in 1971. That was a year before the Lakers won their first championship in Los Angeles. He later went on to become the general manager of the LA Clippers for 22 seasons. His wife Elaine and daughter Crystal were with him when he died today at the age of 86.
Support comes from Ciclavia, catalyzing vibrant public spaces, active transportation, and good health through car-free streets. Ciclavia promotes respect and infrastructure for bike and pedestrian-friendly public spaces. Enjoy these pop-up parks for the day in your favorite people-powered way. Jogging, biking, skating, strolling, or simply spectating. Free and open to all, Ciclavia Sundays generate miles of smiles in neighborhoods all over L.A. Details at www.ciclavia.org.